The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles principally from the Harvard Health Letter. This is the issue of August 2021, and the first thing I'm going to read is called Ask the Doctor, with Dr. Anthony L. Komaroff, MD, Editor-in-Chief. The question that's being asked is, will getting more sleep help protect me from dementia? Question. I get 5 to 6 hours of sleep a night. My doctor says that's not enough and that sleeping longer will protect me from developing dementia. Is there any truth to that? Dr. Komaroff responds, many published studies say that people who sleep less than 7 hours a night or more than 9 hours a night are more likely to develop various chronic diseases, including dementia, than people who sleep 7 to 9 hours per night. However, these studies have had weaknesses. Some did not include very many patients. Others really only studied how long people slept when they reached age 65, not how long they had been sleeping when they were younger. Other studies only lasted around 10 years, making it hard to draw conclusions about ultimate health effects. Most of the studies simply accepted what the study participants said about how long they slept. And sometimes when we report on our healthy lifestyle practices, we tend to fib a little. So while I was inclined to believe that getting enough sleep was important to a person's health and might even protect against dementia, I wasn't entirely convinced. Recently, though, a new study published online April 20th, 2021 by the journal Nature Communications has gone a long way toward convincing me. Researchers selected 8,050-year-olds and then followed them for 25 years. The study participants recorded how long they slept every night, and some even wore devices that measured their body movement, confirming that their reports of how long they slept were accurate. In other words, the study overcame many of the weaknesses of earlier studies. The study results were pretty dramatic. People who at age 50 slept an average of 7 hours a night were compared with those who slept an average of only 6 hours a night. Those who slept less were 22% more likely to develop dementia. The same comparison for people at age 60 found that those who slept less were 37% more likely to develop dementia. For people who slept even less than 6 hours a night, people like you, the risks of developing dementia were even greater. This was an observational study, so we can't say for sure that averaging 7 hours of sleep a night will reduce your risk of developing dementia. To prove that, we'd have to conduct a randomized trial in which thousands of people were required to average 7 hours of sleep a night for 25 years, and thousands of other people were required to average less sleep than that for 25 years. The difficulty of ever conducting a study like that in the real world is obvious. So I'd say, listen to your doctor. I can't guarantee sleeping more will protect you from dementia, but I bet you'll feel better. The next article in the Harvard Health Letter of August 2021 is entitled Top Causes of Blood Clots in the Legs and How to Avoid Them. Don't let a plane ride or an extended couch potato session put you at risk. Here's what you should do to keep your blood flowing. Blood clots that form in the deep veins of the legs can cause leg symptoms. Worse, the clots can break loose and travel through the blood to the heart and then to the lungs, causing a pulmonary embolism. More people die from pulmonary embolism every year in the United States than from breast cancer. What causes DVT and pulmonary embolism? What are the symptoms, and how can you prevent them? After your arteries bring oxygen-rich blood to your legs, your veins send the blood back to your heart and lungs for more oxygen. If blood in the deep leg veins doesn't move fast enough, or if you have a condition that makes you prone to blood clots, a blood clot can develop, says Dr. Sherry Scovel, a vascular surgeon who specializes in venous disease at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. Common blood clot triggers include being bedridden for long periods because of surgery or illness, sitting for long periods, even 3 to 4 hours in a car, plane, or train, getting too little activity, and sitting too much, having blood pool in your legs because valves in the superficial vein don't work properly. In other words, varicose veins, and taking a medication that promotes blood clotting. Your risk for blood clots also increases with older age. A family history of DVT, a previous DVT, cancer, certain genes, COVID-19, heart failure, obesity, pregnancy, sickle cell disease, smoking, spinal cord injury, stroke, untreated varicose veins, and the use of birth control pills or hormone replacement therapy. Be on the lookout for symptoms of two types of blood clots that can form in the legs. The first is a blood clot in the superficial veins. This is called an SVT, or superficial venous thrombosis. It causes redness, tenderness, and pain over varicose veins, Dr. Scovel says. Sometimes an SVT can grow and become a DVT, or deep vein thrombosis. A DVT usually begins in one leg. When you get a blockage, the blood can't leave your leg easily. The leg can become swollen rather suddenly and very painful, Dr. Scovel says. If your legs don't normally get swollen, but one leg becomes swollen over a few days, that may be a sign of danger. If part of that deep vein clot breaks off and travels to the lungs, a PE, or pulmonary embolism, occurs. The clot gets stuck in blood vessels in the lung. You stop getting enough blood flow there, and that part of the lung dies. You have shortness of breath and chest pain when you take a deep breath, Dr. Scovel says. There are apps available to help you to determine your risk for getting a DVT. Dr. Scovel recommends an app called Caprini DVT Risk. That's Caprini DVT Risk, which is available on iOS devices like an iPhone. How can you avoid getting a clot when you're stuck in situations that increase your risk, like a long car ride? Keep the following tips in mind. First, stay hydrated. Avoid excessive alcohol intake and drink lots of water. Secondly, stretch your legs. Every hour or two, stretch your calves and move your ankles back and forth repeatedly. The calf muscles act like pumps and propel blood through the veins, Dr. Scovel says. Move your legs while you're lying down. Bend your knees or point and flex your feet. You should also consider wearing compression stockings. They'll help to prevent swelling and keep blood from pooling in the legs. Avoid crossing your legs and periodically change your position while seated. Also, you should think about getting an aisle seat when you're traveling. On a plane, train, or bus, sit in an aisle seat so you can easily get up and move every few hours. If you have new symptoms indicating the possibility of a DVT or a PE, and if you can't speak immediately to your doctor or nurse, go to the emergency room. It's an emergency, not something to check out on Monday if it's Friday, Dr. Scoville says. Treatment typically involves taking a blood thinner for several months or longer. We also have to figure out why you got the blood clot. If we can't find a reason, you may need to take a blood thinner for a longer time, Dr. Scoville says. And we don't want you to ever get a blood clot again. So you'll need to be proactive about avoiding future risks. The next article in the Harvard Health Letter is entitled, The Benefits of Volunteering Without Leaving Home. By helping others as a virtual or remote volunteer, you'll still reap the rewards of this labor of love. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once said that life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others? Those words from 1957 are still relevant in our world full of inequities and people in need. And interestingly, helping others, particularly volunteering, also appears to boomerang back to us with significant health and wellness benefits. But how can you volunteer if you're homebound due to the pandemic, disability, or transportation issues? Take heart. There is lots of opportunities and many reasons to consider them. Research suggests that volunteering is good for the mind and body. For example, a Harvard study of 13,000 older adults published in the August 2020 issue of the American Journal of Preventive Medicine found that people who volunteered at least 2 hours per week said they were not only happier, more active, and more optimistic than people who didn't volunteer, but also less depressed, hopeless, or lonely. Volunteers reported more contact with friends and more purpose in life than the non-volunteers. Volunteers even had greater longevity by the end of the 4-year study period. They were 40% less likely to die prematurely than non-volunteers. The findings echo other studies that associate volunteering with health, wellness, and longevity. Why is volunteering so powerful? A combination of the following factors may make volunteering good for us. You gain a sense of purpose. You feel like you're part of a broader cause, contributing to a process that helps a lot of people and making a difference in the world. That's enormously energizing. It enhances the motivation to get out of bed and be active, says sociologist Dr. Matthew Lee, an author of the American Journal of Preventive Medicine study and a research director at Harvard University's Human Flourishing Program. People who have a sense of purpose also have greater levels of physical activity, better sleep quality, healthier diets, and lower rates of cardiovascular disease. Also, you connect with others. When you interact with other people, even if it's not in person, you're likely to build relationships and feel more engaged, Lee points out. You get a break from your own problems. You stop worrying about your own situation when you start helping others improve theirs, Lee says. It also develops your sense of virtue. By design, human beings want to become better people, Lee notes. When we nurture others, we flourish and grow. It just feels good. Feeling like you're making a contribution lights up reward centers in the brain and gives you the helper's high, the warm feeling you get when you're helping others. It leads to a strong sense of personal well-being and positive emotions, Lee says. Even if you can't leave home, you can still volunteer your time for a good cause. Here are some ideas. Volunteer online. Thanks to computers, it's common to be a virtual volunteer. For example, you can provide administrative, accounting, or marketing assistance via computer, or you can tutor or mentor someone via video chat. There are opportunities in the arts, business, education, health, medicine, and many other fields. Think about your life experience and who might benefit from it. Volunteer by phone. Telephones are still important in volunteer work. For example, you can use a phone to help raise money for nonprofits, answer a hotline, or make check-in calls to homebound adults. To find opportunities, call an organization you like and ask if it has any remote or virtual volunteer opportunities. Search online for volunteering opportunities in your zip code on websites like Volunteer Match. That's www.volunteermatch.org. VOLUNTEER MATCH.org or on Idealist, www.idealist.org. If you can leave your home but you're not ready to be part of a group, consider assisting neighbors. Someone you know may need help getting the daily mail or paper, walking a dog, preparing meals, helping in their garden, or taking garbage to the curb. Or get creative and come up with other ways to contribute. For example, if you were an art teacher, offer free Zoom classes. If you like writing, send cards or letters to soldiers, nursing home residents, or children in hospitals to brighten their day, Lee suggests. Will helping from home confer the same benefits as volunteering in person? In many ways, it should. You're still connecting deeply with people and being part of something larger than yourself that's meaningful to you. Distance doesn't diminish the story that you become a part of, Lee says, and you get to answer the profound question Dr. King posed so long ago. The next article is entitled, A Vaccine That Can Prevent Shingles. Again, this is from the Harvard Health Letter of August 2021. The Shingrix vaccine, Shingrix, can help you avoid this painful blistering infection and its potential long-lasting pain. By now, you've probably received your COVID-19 vaccination. If you haven't, you should get it. The vaccine significantly lowers the risk of getting COVID-19 and almost completely prevents hospitalization and death from the disease. Remember, vaccines work. Another good example is the vaccine against shingles. Shingles is a viral illness that strikes 1 million people every year in the United States. Your risk of getting shingles and its potential complications increases as you get older. Shingles, also known as herpes zoster, is known for its painful rash. It's caused by the same virus, varicella zoster, that causes chickenpox. Most older adults in the United States have been infected, typically in childhood, although not all have gotten chickenpox. Sometimes the initial infection causes no symptoms. The chickenpox virus never goes away. It hides in your nerve cells and becomes dormant. At some point later in life, the virus can reactivate, move through the nerves, and cause painful blisters when it reaches the skin, says Dr. Howard Lewine, an internist with Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital and chief medical editor of Harvard Health Publishing. Like chickenpox, shingles produces itchy blisters that scab over and heal in a few weeks. A fever, headache, chills, or an upset stomach may also occur during that time. Unlike chickenpox, shingles can cause burning, stabbing, or tingling sensations in inflamed nerves several days before the rash appears. It usually occurs only on one side of the body, one side of the head and face, one side of the torso, or one arm or leg. Shingles or herpes zoster can get into the eye, posing the risk of vision loss when it involves the face. It can also, in rare cases, cause pneumonia, hearing loss, brain inflammation, temporary facial paralysis, or death. Up to 18% of people who get shingles continue to suffer from pain long after the other symptoms go away. The ongoing pain is called postherpetic neuralgia, or PHN. The pain occurs because the virus damages the nerve endings, Dr. Lewine explains. The older you are, the longer the pain can last. PHN pain may come and go, or it may be present all the time. In either case, it can be debilitating. It might keep you from going to work, or exercising, or just getting through the day, Dr. Lewine points out. PHN can also bring on depression, anxiety, weight loss, or sleep problems. You should call your doctor as soon as you suspect shingles, especially if it's near your eyes. The sooner you fight the virus, the better. If we catch it within a few days of the rash appearing, we can prescribe antiviral medication like Valtrex or Valacyclovir or Famvir or Famcyclovir to speed healing and reduce the risk of PHN, Dr. Lewine says. To relieve the pain, doctors recommend acetaminophen or an over-the-counter anti-inflammatory drug like ibuprofen or naproxen. The other names for ibuprofen are Advil and Motrin. The other names for naproxen is Aleve. Doctors may prescribe a stronger drug if the pain is severe. If you do develop PHN, doctors can prescribe medications like Neurontin or Gabapentin, or Elavil or Amitriptyline, which reduce the signals damaged nerves send to the brain. The best way to avoid shingles or PHN is to get the shingles vaccine called Shingrix, given in two doses. The vaccine contains a protein from dead varicella zoster virus. The shot is 90% effective and is recommended for adults age 50 or older, even if you've had shingles before, or if you received an older shingles vaccine called Zostavax, which is much less effective and is no longer given in the United States. The shot is also recommended if you don't recall ever having had chickenpox, because you might have had an asymptomatic case. The vaccine should be avoided if you currently have shingles, are allergic to components of the vaccine, or are pregnant or breastfeeding. Shingrix doses need to be given 2 to 6 months apart, and each dose may cause intense side effects for a few days, like fever, fatigue, muscle or stomach pain, chills, headache, and nausea. How long should you wait to get the shingles vaccine if you're still in the process of getting your COVID-19 vaccine shots? We don't have a lot of information about that, but current guidance suggests you wait at least 2 weeks after getting your COVID shot to get the shingles vaccine. And I'd say you might even want to wait a couple of months to be sure. After that, it should be okay to get the shingles vaccine, and it should protect you for years. The article also contains a table about vaccinations for older adults. The COVID-19 vaccine should be given to all adults. And it says that the frequency may change as the pandemic unfolds. Hepatitis A vaccine is sometimes given depending on exposure. Hepatitis B vaccine should be given to all at-risk adults. Influenza vaccine should be given to all adults on an annual basis. Measles vaccine should be given to all adults born in or after 1957. Pneumonia, bacteremia, and meningitis vaccine, which is called the pneumococcal vaccine, should be given to all adults age 65 or older, and they should get a dose of the PPSV23 vaccine. The shingles vaccine should be given to all adults age 50 or older. Remember, the shingles vaccine is 2 shots. And finally, the tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis vaccine should be given to all adults once every 10 years. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I sure hope you enjoyed it.